If I Had a Hammer, Peter, Paul and Mary. It's a selection of our guest on Sunday night, the Most Reverend Christopher Saunders, the Catholic Bishop of Broome, up in the northwest of Australia. And he's our guest as part of the Catholic Bishops Conference, partly in light of the statement by our Prime Minister last week, to which Bishop Saunders responded, "What choice?" to the Prime Minister's Tony Abbott's comments after about Aboriginal people living in remote communities having a lifestyle choice. Bishop Christopher Saunders, welcome to Sunday Night.
Thank you very much indeed. It's lovely to be here.
The statement the Australian Catholic Bishops Conference put out with regard to the Prime Minister's statement about lifestyle choice for those living in remote communities was quite prompt. It came out just a couple of days after the PM's comments. This is not the usual form for the Catholic Bishops Conference. There must have been some strength of feeling about it.
Well, yes, I have to say that I was speaking on behalf of the commission that I chair, which is a Bishop's Commission for Relations with Aboriginals and Torres Strait Islanders. So I was speaking in that capacity, not necessarily representing all bishops, but by a number of phone calls that I've had and the conversations I had prior to putting that out, I think that there's across the board, there's a great sympathy, if not 100%, for the remarks that we expressed.
Well, let me quote one of the lines that you used, you quoting, "After 200 years of colonisation and dispossession, surely out of fairness we owe something to Australia's First Nations in the way of respect and recompense. Recent research has found that where Aboriginal communities are supported to serve as models of landscape management or as the source of new community initiatives, they have a far better outcome in health and education." So you're saying not only is this a bad policy, it's incorrect in its assumptions.
Well, exactly. I think it's a policy that seems to have come out in a sea of ignorance without any reference to the history of what has happened in this nation in 200 years. The problems that we're trying to deal with today are problems that have been made long ago. And it's a sad fact that in the way that Aboriginals have been treated, they have never been consulted about things that affect them. And I think that what we're seeing now is an extension of that view that says we know best. And I'm afraid it'll fail like the rest of them.
Now, you're somebody, as the Bishop of Broome, who not only has an official role as the chair of the Bishop's Commission for Relations with Aborigines and Torres Strait Islanders. You're also the bishop of one of Australia's largest dioceses, 773,000 square K, a population of around 33,500, about 8,000 of those are Catholic. A number of your missions in the area have historic roots, such as Columbaroo and others. You'd have some experience and understanding of what these outstation communities are and how they function. Can you just give us your perspective on those communities?
Sure. Firstly, I'd say to put that area in some sort of identity, I'm fond of saying to my Victorian brother bishops that it's 3.7 times the size of Victoria. So that gives us a bit of idea of the area. Now, within that, we have five missions that have been started by the Catholic Church. The first of those goes back till 1890. And there's a long tradition here through the French Cistercians, the German Palatines, the Irish and Australian John of God Sisters and the Josephites and a number of other orders of servicing Aboriginal communities and living closely with the people. In this particular era that we live in, of course, there are changes about, and Aboriginal communities themselves have changed to some degree. But largely what identifies them is that they are the traditional lands of the people who are living on them. These are lands to which people are connected spiritually and historically. They are lands and environments of which they know the story and they appreciate the environments. So what we're dealing with now is people in their own country. And they call it country, and they call it country because that is largely what they know. And their laws and their stories are about their own country. And what their country says is many things, but it says something, and largely something, about themselves.
there seems to be an underlying assumption, and one can't read into what the Prime Minister said, you can take it at face value, an underlying assumption that really Aboriginal communities must get on board with where Australia is headed. It's no longer an option to expect Australia to fund people to try and live a semi-traditional, semi-nomadic life if that can't be self-sustaining. And that seems to be the assumption, that Australians shouldn't have to underwrite the lifestyles of others.
Yes, I suppose it's not dissimilar to the economic rationalists who today are looking at those who are living off their pensions and saying, well, we're not sure if we have the obligation to support you in your old age. But it's sadly, when the economic rationalists are running the ship, when the pencil sharpeners are on the bridge, what we forget sometimes is the society that we are in is a society because it looks after those who are in need as well as those who are in want. And we have to try and work out a balance between those who want and those who need. Now, people who were enjoying their existence on this land before European colonisation took place shouldn't have to suffer for the effects of colonisation, which was, in fact, a series of actions that denied them access often to their land and the use of their land for economic and cultural purposes. I think that there's such a thing as recompense, given the history of what has happened. And part of that recompense from our society may be to say, listen, we do recognise finally, after 200 years, you have a right to the land to which you are attached culturally and spiritually, and we have an obligation to support you because we've taken so much of that away from you. I believe that that should be the driving force of our economy, the economy of that helps people to live the sort of life they have a right to live, not an economics, rather, who determines that we should all be living the same.
Some people have said that that's sit-down money.
Well, some people would say that that's sit-down money. You could say the same thing about pensioners, I suppose. But on the other hand, is it sit-down money or is it recompense? I mean, if people have a lifestyle of living off the land and enjoying that, and all of their cultural practices about what they do and say about the land and what the land, in a sense, says to them, how can we turn around and say, well, now you have to pick up another economy? We have to realise, too, the Aboriginals have their own economy, their own way of helping each other, and it's an extraordinary system and a very complex system. Simplistically, we can sit in our happy towers in Canberra or elsewhere and say, this is the way you have to live. I don't think that we have the right to do that. I think rather we have the responsibility in justice to help people to live the way that they originally lived and the way that they still want to live today.
Others say that this is a generational question. That is, as if we're going to be fair to younger Aboriginal children, the next generation coming through, they have to be given the resources to enter a modern economy if they wish to. They have to have appropriate education facilities. They have to have all those things that accompany the schooling and the health conditions and all of those things. And you can't do that. You can't multiply it X number of times for each remote community. You need to bring people in to population centres to give the next generation a chance.
Well, we have several examples up here where Aboriginal children are picked up in smaller remote communities and are taken to larger communities where they attend school. This happens at Warman, it happens at Beagle Bay. There are other places that it happens too. The children happily come in for a day's education and drive back out again. So I think we can run the argument that this is already happening. And if there are children who are living in places where they have no educational opportunities, then we need to negotiate and consult with families about what we can do to make it easier for them. It may be a question of providing transport services. You know, we have children on cattle stations who attend the School of the Air. Are those facilities available in those remote Aboriginal communities? And are they taught how to use them? I accept the fact, and as everybody does, of course, that today's Australia and today's Outback Australia isn't the same as it was yesterday. However, that doesn't give us the right to trample over other people's rights.
You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia through Radio Australia via the web to the world. Our guest is the Catholic Bishop of Broome, Most Reverend Christopher Saunders. He is also a member of the Australian Catholic Bishops Conference and chair of the Bishops Commission for Relations with Aborigines and Torres Strait Islanders. We're concentrating on the remarks made during the week by our Prime Minister. Some say misunderstood, others say no. What he said may not quite accurately reflect his position, but it does betoken an attitudinal difference. Bishop Saunders, do you believe that underpinning this is a fundamental, if you like, divide in Australian society on these issues, that we're actually talking about the nature of our civil society and how that operates and functions, and that there is a deep divide here?
I think so. I don't think this nation has ever come to grips with the way that we treated Aboriginal people during the early years of colonisation. And it's not that long ago that tribes of Aboriginals were being suppressed up in this area in order that cattle stations may expand and the pastoral industry may become one of the great industries in Australia today. It did so on the backs of Aboriginal labour and by using their land. And I don't think we've ever come to grips with the fact that we've behaved in the most abhorrent way, which is one of the reasons why we need to look at things like the Australian Constitution very carefully and see what's lacking in that that might acknowledge an Aboriginal presence in this country. But it also begets the question as to what is our ongoing relationship with Aboriginal people? Do we feel an obligation in justice to see that what was wrong is set right and that what is bad is set good, and that the hopelessness that some of them live under is replaced with a sense of hopefulness? I think we need to have a conversation firstly with our conscience and our Lord and God, and with our neighbour and with the Aboriginal people, and saying, how can we better be Australians, all of us together? And I think you'll find the Aboriginals are far more forgiving and understanding than we ever could be.
Well, let's talk about a couple of practical issues along this path. In recent weeks, what the Prime Minister has said has been reinforced some cuts that had been announced. That is, the federal government had announced cutbacks to funding of certain Aboriginal activities. The Western Australian government had said as a result of those funding cutbacks, it was going to move to close down some of these communities. So these remarks have to be seen in a context. And the wider context of both of those things is the intervention, which still applies. And the intervention has components in it which revolve around control on income to affect access to alcohol and other things. There's a broad strategy at work there. From your perspective, how appropriate is that strategy? Let's start with the immediate, the cutbacks, and the link to the intervention.
Well, I think we have to look at the cutbacks as they are. I haven't taken on board all the finer details of it, but I do believe that there are sufficient monies that have come from the feds at this stage to the state government for the state government to maintain the services that it has been maintaining in the past. I had a meeting the other day with Nigel Scullion, the Minister for Aboriginal Affairs, who is in Broome, and he assures me that all this has been budgeted correctly. It's just, how does the state government who receives this money, how do they apply it, how do they use it? And I'm wondering, after having spoken with him, I'm wondering whether or not there isn't some quick smoke and mirrors happening here. If the federal government have given the money and there's sufficient there to keep these essential services running, then why don't we keep them running? What's going on? Secondly, the other thing Nigel Scullion told me very clearly was that the federal government did not share the same opinion about the closure of Aboriginal communities that the state government is putting out there. And it was only an hour later, after I had that conversation, that the Prime Minister made his remarks. So there is some confusion in the leadership of this country, and it would seem that leadership in this country, both at a state and federal level, is in shambles. And it's largely in shambles because we are not respecting the rights of people to sit down and discuss with them what their needs are and what their rights might be. I think we can afford more to help those in the marginalised in our society, which includes the Aboriginal people. They're the largest single group of people or race of people who are marginalised and on the bottom rung of our socioeconomic ladder. Surely we have an obligation to be able to help them, and surely we can do it. The problem in this country is the distribution of wealth. It's not that there's not enough money, it's just where it goes and who's got it. And I think that we need to look very carefully about what our priorities are in the economic machine that drives our country.
Well, let's apply that to the intervention. The intervention, if there are criticisms of it, seem to be it's a top-down, one-size-fits-all formula. What's really needed is care to actually be with communities and help them develop their solutions to what are perceived as the problems.
Yes. Yes, I think so. There are some aspects of the intervention that are quite useful in the sense that, for instance, income quarantining being made available to people in a voluntary capacity. And there are some families I know who have voluntarily signed on for that, and they reckon that it suits them and suits them well. And they're managing their families and their finances better by having some part of their income quarantined and set aside for the purchase of goods and services. The difficulty comes when you've got junior bureaucrats who are put in a position of deciding and having the authority to decide who shall be forced to go on to this income quarantining, who shall be forced to go onto this system. And I don't think we do ourselves or the Aboriginal people any service at all. Nor do we show any respect for them by forcing them into economic circumstances that we ourselves would not want to be in or would not go into. I think that that part of the intervention had good points and poor points.
Do you think that the income quarantining is something that, well, people have talked about the income quarantining as something that should be actually spread more widely, and that it could be applied to other suburban communities, for instance, not just Aboriginal communities? This idea that people are not capable of controlling their access to resources runs up against a human rights community who say, well, hang on, you can't make decisions like that on a blanket basis for all people. I mean, people change the way they behave from time to time, from month to month, year to year, week to week even. Yeah. This is, again, the problem is a sort of one-size-fits-all that doesn't really function in the real world.
Yes, and it's based on a broad brush philosophy that says that we know what's best for you. It wasn't all that long ago that we were having discussions about the stolen generation, and we were hearing things like, we knew what was best for you and we did what was best for you, and that's why it existed. And unfortunately, I think this is the same little echo at work, that we have a problem, and the way that we solve it is by forcing you into a mould and a way of living and a way of being that we ourselves wouldn't want to be in, but we think it's right for you. I think if people have problems, and they do, and they have difficulties existing and coping with the major economy that drives this nation, then we should be spending more time and more money assisting them to understand and appreciate, not forcing them like some sort of second-class citizens. I mean, do we want a country in which some people have all the rights and others have lesser rights? I don't think so. That's not the sort of Australia that our forebears dreamt about.
You're on Sunday Night. Our guest is the Most Reverend Christopher Saunders, a Catholic Bishop of Broome, but also Chairman of the Australian Catholic Bishops Conference Commission for Relations with Aborigines and Torres Strait Islanders. Bishop Saunders, let me move you to one other area. On Friday, the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Catholic Council is quoted as saying, the Prime Minister's use of the term lifestyle choices is an insult to Aboriginal people. To dispossess another generation of our people will deal a further blow to health, education and living standard disparities between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians. Additionally, the burden on other communities will increase as people are forced to move. That Irelander Catholic Council, I take it, is constituted on a roughly democratic basis. That is, people come to it as part of a national elective process. So this would be a statement that you would take quite seriously and expect the country to take quite seriously.
Yes, the NATSIC, as we call them, the National Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander Catholic Council. NATSIC are the primary advisors to the Bishops' Conference on matters pertaining to Aboriginals and Aboriginal welfare and the matter of religion and faith in terms of service of Aboriginal communities. So, yes, we do take it very seriously. And they're expressing there rather clearly the way that they feel. And it's very difficult to argue with somebody about the way they feel. And they feel that this is another expression, another articulation of a huge disrespect that's adding to the gulf between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people. And yes, we do take that seriously.
We're looking at a cabinet in Australia which, to an almost unprecedented degree, has members of the Catholic faith in the cabinet, yet the message doesn't seem to be seeping through. And these are people who are not just sort of confessionally Catholic, but active in their religious practice. Mm. Is there a disjunction here between faith in going to church and faith as lived in action, or faith as understood in social terms? Where's the disjunction here in your mind?
Well, I wouldn't want to presume what's happening in their mind and souls individually, but I think there's always a credibility gap between who we say we are and what we do, and that probably goes just as much for me as it does for them. The fact that their actions can affect public policy and can affect the nation at large has more serious consequences that we need to consider. I imagine that even though there are Catholics on the bridge, so to speak, of this ship, there are many philosophies and many religiosities that are driving from the engine room. Sometimes politics has been described as the ability to be able to balance conflicting interests. And I think that what we've come across here is some true conflicting interests, and our members of Parliament that you're referring to are trying to cope with it the best way they can. I don't really want to be in the position of trying to judge them. I don't think that's right. In terms of their religious practice, but I will discuss their policies.
Yes, I ask it in the context of what's become almost a topic of public discussion on a weekly basis. That is what seem as a shift in sensibility of the church with Pope, represented in particular by Pope Francis, and the way in which Francis is saying your faith has got to be seen as a lived set of actions, not just a set of subscribed beliefs.
Well, I certainly can't argue with that. And if I was talking to them individually, I'd probably be saying the same thing. I don't want to sound that I'm sitting here behind this, as though I'm sitting behind this microphone, lecturing people. But yes, the Holy Father rightly points out that what we believe in has to be seen in the way we live. And I suppose sometimes when you're applying policies, you're not able to apply simply your own philosophy or your own religious beliefs to that policy. As I said before, you have to take into account competing interests. And in this country, there are some very big voices who've got lots of money and lots of influence. We have a long tradition of this country listening to people, no matter how silly they are, listening to them as long as they've got money. And there are people who, with money, have influence over the way this country runs. And it's going to take a very brave set of people to stand up to them and to change it.
Most Reverend Christopher Saunders, Bishop of Broome, thanks for joining us on Sunday night.
God bless you. Thanks very much indeed.